On Monday, the United States government made an unprecedented move against Iran.
I am announcing our intent to designate the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including its Quds Force, as a foreign terrorist organization, in accordance with Section 219 of the Immigration and Nationality Act.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo there. This new label for Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC, goes into effect in 1 week and represents the first time the U.S. has ever officially labeled part of another government's military a terrorist organization.
This designation is a direct response to an outlaw regime and should surprise no one.
The label imposes sanctions on the financial assets of the IRGC, and in response, Iran designated the United States military as a sponsor of terror. The moves are just the latest signs of escalating tensions between the U.S. and Iran in recent months. I have two people with me to walk us through the Trump administration's decision. Robin Wright is a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and contributing writer at The New Yorker. Robin, nice to have you back on.
Great to be with you.
And Farnaz Fasihi is an Iranian-American journalist and senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Farnaz.
Thank you for having me.
So, Farnaz, let's start with you. What exactly is the IRGC? Is it like other militaries when we think of military?
Not quite. The IRGC was formed after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, mainly with the responsibility to secure Iran's borders and safeguard the revolution, because they felt that they were threatened and they needed a more elite force, a special forces within the establishment to protect Iran. It is not a militia. It is an armed force very much within the regime of the Islamic Republic. But gradually over the past 40 years, the role of IRGC has evolved significantly. If you look at Iran today, it is no longer just a clerical regime. It is a military regime run by the IRGC. The IRGC dominate the economy. They dominate policy. They dominate trade. They dominate every sector of Iranian society. They're extremely intertwined with the government, and it's very difficult to separate the two.
Robin, what is it that the IRGC has done that warrants the Trump administration labeling it as a terrorist organization?
The IRGC has multiple branches. It has its own army, navy, and air force, but it also has a wing that has been the most active across the Middle East. It's called the Quds Force, and it was involved in supporting the regime of President Assad in Syria, for example. It has been very instrumental in supporting Shiite militias in Iraq. Its outreach to Hezbollah has been fundamental in the nurturing and forming of what is the most, perhaps, expansive militia, Shiite militia, that's now has branches across the Middle East. So it's been engaged in fostering and supporting others, but it's also in the past been instrumental in encouraging or facilitating attacks on the United States and its facilities. In Lebanon in 1983 and 84, the embryonic form of Hezbollah attacked two American embassies and the Marine compound. And the attack on the Marine compound still ranks to this day as the largest single loss of U.S. military life in a single incident since Iwo Jima during World War II. It was also involved in supporting militias that are responsible, according to the fact sheet put out by the White House yesterday, for 603 American deaths in Iraq by, again, facilitating weaponry to militias that were fighting the U.S. presence during its 8-year occupation. And so it has been very active in trying to check American influence or power on the ground in places that are important to the United States.
And does labeling this organization a terrorist group, Robin, does that give the administration any power? Does it make it easier to change the rules of engagement with Iran, or is it just a label?
Well, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards have been sanctioned many times before, whether specifically by individuals or branches or some of its economic outlets. I'm not clear that this is going to go much further. The real question I think that's out there and hasn't been answered is, what is the U.S. intent? Is it to use the labeling of the IRGC as a terrorist group as a means or a form of justifying some kind of attack on it or its leadership, or to justify, for example, if there's some kind of encounter in the Persian Gulf where there have often been very close calls with Iranian Revolutionary Guard patrol boats. Is it something that the U.S. now has grounds to do things militarily? The big danger, I think, is that the United States has about 23,000 troops in key countries where the Revolutionary Guards are also very active. We have 2,000 in Syria still, more than 5,000 in Iraq, and at least 14,000 in Afghanistan. One of the reasons the Pentagon was so opposed to this was, first of all, does it make U.S. troops more vulnerable in these countries? But also, what is the danger that other countries where special forces are engaged, that they may decide also to declare the United States a terrorist group, as the Iranians have now done? They've declared that Central Command, which is the branch which is deployed in the Middle East and South Asia, is a terrorist group. So this is the kind of thing that is very provocative. And the question, I think, among a lot of Iran experts is the goal really regime change? Is it some kind of bigger confrontation or to justify kinetic action? Or is it really a political move trying to pressure Iran back to the negotiating table, which I don't think this move will do?
Farnaz, how about Iranian civilians? What could the impact of this be on them?
Because the IRGC is involved in every sector of Iranian society, this could unintentionally criminalize a lot of ordinary Iranians. If you are a young male Iranian and you've been drafted to do your military service, the lottery system could place you within an IRGC unit for that mandatory service. So then are you labeled a terrorist? If you are a manufacturer in Iran or an industrialist and you're producing goods and the IRGC buys it for one of their businesses or constructions, even residential complexes, are you then aiding terrorists? I find that the overlap of IRGC within Iranian society is such that it is very easy to see how ordinary, innocent Iranians could get caught up in this. I would like to also mention something that Robin addressed. This move by the U.S., the goal of it is not clear. If the goal is to bring Iranians to the negotiating table to get a better Iran nuclear deal, as President Trump has pledged since his campaign, this is not going to achieve that goal. What it will do is strengthen Iran's hardliners who have long advocated you can't trust the United States. And it will also radicalize the moderate voices. Yesterday, the deputy foreign minister of Iran, Abbas Araghchi, who's considered a moderate, who was one of the main negotiators in the nuclear deal, said that from now on, every American base in the Middle East is considered a terrorist base, and every American serviceman was considered a terrorist. These are pretty startling words coming from a moderate voice within the Iranian government and a deputy foreign minister.
Also, Farnaz, as we know, the U.S. and Iranian militaries are often, they work close together. In the case of ISIS, they fought the same adversary. What does this change, if anything?
Well, it would make it very hard for the U.S. to even indirectly engage with Iran on common goals like battling ISIS or terrorism or stabilizing Iraq or now negotiating to bring peace to Yemen. Iran and U.S. have had these conversations through whether the U.N. or through intermediaries or the Iraqis when these issues have come up. And it's now hard to see how the U.S. would engage in at any level if the other side is involved in IRGC. And as I said before, IRGC is involved in everything. There are Iranian parliamentarians who are members of the IRGC. There are diplomats and ambassadors all around the world that were members of IRGC. So are you going to purge them? Are they going to be deported? It opens up a lot of questions. But the biggest question, as Robin pointed out, is what is the goal here? Is the goal to put Iran and the U.S. on a collision path and provoke a military attack? Or is the goal to rein in Iran and have it retreat from the Middle East? This is not going to make the IRGC retreat.
I also want to note here that there are several members of the Trump inner circle, if you will, Rudy Giuliani among them, who've taken paid speaking gigs with an Iranian organization called the People's Mujahideen, or the MEK. Let's take a listen to a clip that we have from one of Giuliani's speeches.
The changes in Washington are very exciting. You saw on this stage, you saw John Bolton. You remember John Bolton. He's going to be President Trump's national security advisor. You think he changed his mind? No, in fact, if anything, John Bolton has become more determined that there needs to be regime change in Iran, that the nuclear agreement needs to be burned, and that you need to be in charge of that country.
Robin, who are the People's Mujahideen, and what is the involvement here with Bolton and Giuliani?
They're known as the MEK, and this is a group that was on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations until 2012. It had been involved earlier in attacks on Americans, the death of Americans, both diplomats and military officials, and it sued to get off the terrorism list. It has every year held an annual rally in Paris. It's a strange group. It is Islamist. It's a cult, basically, and has very little support inside Iran today, even though it was originally part of the revolution. It split early on, and it went on to have a camp in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. He was supported financially and in terms of weaponry by Saddam Hussein. And after the U.S. intervention, then they dispersed around the world. And one of their major operating centers is in Paris, and they have an annual conference every year, and they bring people over to endorse the MEK. It's one of the few visible things the group actually does. And it has had very influential names come to Paris to endorse it, including John Bolton for 8 years was a keynote speaker, and Giuliani has been very visible for more than a decade in doing work with the MEK. But others from both parties, whether it's Bill Richardson, Tom Ridge, Patrick Kennedy, Louis Free, former head of the FBI. And it's always been mystifying to me why Americans would support this group, which doesn't really resonate inside Iran and would not be the viable alternative. Another question all of the new actions taken by the Trump administration bring up is, you know, where do they see an alternative to the current regime, if indeed they want regime change? Because it's striking that even though a lot of Iranians are very unhappy with their own government, whether it's because of corruption, employment problems, its intervention in other parts of the region, that you have not seen a movement in a decade that could be a challenge to the government or replace the government. In other words, there's no seed there for a counter-revolution. And the MEK is an exiled group now. And it at its last rally, many of the people who attended weren't even Iranian. There was a very interesting piece done by The Guardian how they offered 25 euros and a bus ticket to Paris for their convention. So I don't think it resonates, but it's a group that has mysterious resources to buy out a lot of prominent Western official to make it look like it has some credibility.
There's another interesting part of this story, and Farnar is wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about this here. The Trump Organization did finalize a deal for Trump Tower Baku in Azerbaijan, and some of the people that the president was dealing with at the time were members of the IRGC. How does that square with this most recent declaration by the president, Farnaz?
Well, that could jeopardize the Trump Organization if that, in fact, they were, as we saw the New Yorker report, involved in any business dealing that involved the IRGC. The IRGC, through their conglomerates, development conglomerates and economic conglomerates, have a lot of investments in the Caucasus, in Georgia, in Azerbaijan. They were in the Gulf, and because of the sanctions, moved up toward investing in the Caucasus. We did a story about how involved they were in Georgia's economy. And I think that the New Yorker article pointed out that the Trump Organization knew that one of the business partners was involved with the IRGC, and that could potentially be then place the president's company in jeopardy of, I don't know, violating a terrorist rule that he has imposed. I mean, there are all sorts of consequences.
And Robin, last question for you. Does this week's move by the United States and the Trump administration change the balance of power in the region at all?
On paper, it doesn't really change very much. I think that there will be a number of people within the U.S. military deeply concerned about where they can deploy, where the Iranians, they have to watch in every direction now, everything they do, for fear that there will be some effort by the Revolutionary Guards or its proxies to say, hey, we're more powerful than you calculated, and we're going to put the United States in its place. You know, this really escalates the level of tensions in the region about each other. And we all have to watch and see if that ends up playing out in some kind of provocation and a confrontation that I don't think anybody really wants.
Robin Wright is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and contributing writer at The New Yorker. And Farnaz Fasihi is an Iranian-American journalist and senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Texas! Texas! Beautiful, lovely Texas!
Tax season is here. And at this time of year, working poor people in the U.S., those families making less than $20,000 a year, may get some much-needed extra cash if they qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit.
It's one of our largest anti-poverty programs. As far as all of our programs go, it lifts more children out of poverty every year than any other program. It's about 5 million kids who get above the poverty line as a result of this credit.
That's Paul Keel, a reporter who covers the IRS for ProPublica. And Keel recently found that low-income families who file for the tax credit are audited by the IRS at much higher rates than wealthier Americans. And the auditing process can have a big impact on the families who rely on that extra money.
The immediate thing is the refund doesn't come, and that creates its own crisis because they always have plans for it before it comes, right? It's to pay off credit card debt or whatever. So that problem stays with you, and it can lead to another snowball of maybe you could take out a payday loan or whatever to get by. I recently did a series of stories about consumer bankruptcy, and bankruptcies in this country surge in February and March of every year because that's when people have money to pay an attorney to file. So it's a really big deal for people.
What, on average, does a family get in terms of this tax credit? How much are we talking about?
The average refund is going to be around $2,000 to $3,000. It can go a little bit higher depending on how many kids. It's based on how many children you have in the home. And so the main thing is whether your child qualifies as a qualifying child in the language of our tax law. That can be kind of a difficult question for the recipient of the credit to prove, because in a lot of low-income families, you're more likely to have situations where a grandparent is taking care of a child, or there might be more change in the living situation. So it's much easier to sort of prove that the child is qualifying in quote-unquote traditional household. But there's a lot of research to show that in the low-income households, you're more likely to have these non-traditional setups, and that's where the IRS is going to go and say, hey, prove that this three-year-old lived with you for over 6 months of the relevant tax year.
Why would this set off an audit at all?
Well, it's very efficient in terms of claiming the credit because there's no bureaucracy to go through it to claim it. You just claim it on your tax returns. And going back to the 1990s, Republicans have been very focused on the idea that people are claiming this and who don't deserve it.
Is this the sense that people are going to take advantage of the system like they did with welfare? And I'm having big quotes here.
Right. Yeah, no, the concern is that people are going to claim it. The fraud is basically the concern. So since the 1990s, even going back to Newt Gingrich, Republicans have put pressure on the IRS to minimize the amount of, I guess, incorrect claims that are made. And so it's been a real priority for the IRS in terms of how many audits they're doing of this program, to the point where for a while now, it's accounted for more than a third of all audits that the IRS does. It's in the hundreds of thousands of audits. And that mix has been increasing because going back to 2010, the Republican Congress has been cutting the budget of the IRS. And a major effect of this is that it's led to a massive drop in staffing at the IRS. And these kinds of audits of people who claim this credit, are largely automated in terms of how they start. So someone at the top of the IRS decides, you know, we want to audit so many people. And then you have computers choose who, you know, flag people as, you know, potential problems. And then, like, basically a letter goes out from a computer. And, you know, by the hundreds of thousands, these letters go out. So as the IRS is dwindling in size because it's losing staff because of these budget cuts, this is one area of its audits has been more resistant to that drop in audits because there's such automation involved. But the flip side of that is, if you're on the other side of those audits, you get one of these letters and you raise your hand and say, hey, I deserve this credit. And you send in a pack of documents showing that your three-year-old lived in your house for over 6 months of the year. That's when someone on the other end needs to be there. A person needs to look at that at the IRS. And then for that reason, there's been a massive bottleneck. I've talked to people who have been audited under this program, and they get a letter saying, thanks for sending in your documents. We'll get back to you in 6 months. That's a problem because, I said, people really rely on these refunds. And so it's a real crisis when they don't come, and then for it not to come for another year, and then for it to potentially affect your next year's tax returns is when it becomes, you know, something that can really create a problem, like a spiraling sort of problem for people. You know, problems create other problems. It snowballs.
We're talking about a lot of families here who are low-income families, poor families. I'm hesitant to even ask how this breaks down on racial lines, but often when we talk about wealth in this country, it often breaks down pretty interestingly. So what have you found in terms of who is being audited?
Yeah, so first of all, the IRS says obviously they don't look at people's race when they do audits, and they also say that they don't look at where people live in their audit mix. From their perspective, that's a way for them to prevent any, you know, discriminatory practices.
But your reporting is found different.
Right. So there's actually an economist who worked at the IRS for many decades, and he's actually in retirement, and he did this study looking at, okay, if this is how the IRS is conducting audits, if this is the mix of audits, what does it look like in terms of where these people live, who we are auditing? If you put those numbers together, you see right from the beginning, the South jumps out, and that's a reflection of there's a lot of low-income people in the South who are working poor and are claiming this credit, and particularly, like, you know, the Black Belt of the South, you know, the southern counties of Alabama, Mississippi is the most audited state per capita when you run these numbers. And then certain other things jump out, like Native American reservations and, you know, along the Texas border with Mexico, you can see there's a lot of counties there that are mostly Latino. So this is what it means if the IRS has these priorities and audits in this way.
It feels somewhat punitive. It feels somewhat, and I'm saying somewhat because of I'm thinking back to the word fraud here, the assumption of fraud. There's almost an assumption of criminality here at this point on the part of low-income recipients of this credit. Let's talk about people who tend to actually make a lot of money and tend to actually potentially not get audited as much. People with a lot of money, people with real money here. What does the audit process look like for rich people?
Yeah, so you can't audit a rich person the same way that these audits where a computer spits out a letter. In order to audit, you know, a billionaire, or even a very wealthy person, to audit a business, a corporation, you need a really skilled auditor to do that work. And as a result of these budget cuts, people are not being replaced. These audits just aren't done because there's no one to do them.
So let me get this straight. So yeah. It's easier to audit a poor person than it is a rich person.
When you're talking about trying to trace income from someone's trust to a, you know, a pass-through entity or an LLC, you know, it gets very complicated very fast. And so one thing we've been trying to show is how that aspect of what the IRS is doing has been badly damaged by these budget cuts over the years. If you make less than $20,000 a year, well, particularly if you claim the earned income credit, you're more likely to be audited. Then you have to go all the way up to people who make more than $1 million a year to get to an audit rate that's larger or higher.
Paul Keel is a reporter with ProPublica covering the IRS. Paul, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is for the unforgettable, the swift and sweet ones who hurdled history and opened a world of possible, the ones who survived America by any means necessary, and the ones who didn't.
Author Kwame Alexander doesn't talk down to kids. Instead, he finds new ways to engage them, often through poetry. His newest work, The Undefeated, is a picture book with illustrations by artist Kadir Nelson. And it features a poem that Kwame started writing over 10 years ago, which was inspired by the birth of his second daughter and the presidency of Barack Obama. Most of the book is an empowering look at the history of Black Americans.
The real reason we celebrate Black History Month is so that children in general, Black children in particular, can know that no matter what type of challenges they face in their lives, they can make it to the other side. That there's a lot of persistence and grit and this idea that Maya Angelou talked about. Though we may face defeat, we must never be defeated.
But the undefeated doesn't shy away from the disturbing history of racism in the United States. There are pages devoted to the transatlantic slave trade and victims of police brutality.
I think as children's book authors, we have a responsibility to really help young people imagine a better world. And so the world may be kind of messed up. And I tell kids, and in particular my daughter all the time, yeah, the adults have kind of screwed it up, but it's up to you to sort of make it right. And where can you sort of get the tools to imagine what it looks like? And I think you get those tools between the pages of a book.
I asked Kwame how he approaches conversations on painful topics, both in his work and with his own children.
I decided as soon as my kid, who's 10 now, came home and had questions about slavery, that's when I'd start talking about it. Because who wants to really talk about it? It's tough. It's hard. It's tragic. And she came home at 9 and shared this story that happened in her class, in her fourth grade class, about slavery, and she had questions. And that was sort of my moment to say, okay, this is why we got to talk. This is when we got to speak about this with her. And so I think in the book, I just try to deal with some of these subjects because they're important, but I try to use poetry as a way to make it more palatable, to make it more digestible. I think poetry is that because it has so much white space, because it uses rhythm, because it's so few words, and it uses metaphors and figurative language, people can digest it.
We had a conversation recently here on the show about reparations. And one of the things that's come up here is, once again, the sort of ahistorical lens through which we view American history and particularly Black history. And one of the people in the roundtable suggested that isn't just cheating Black Americans, it's also cheating white Americans from the full understanding of what happened in our past. When you write a book like this, are you also thinking about that? Does that come into play in terms of who your audience, who you're hoping will pick this up?
Tanzina, I think books are mirrors and windows. And so a kid reads a book, they got to be able to see themselves. They got to be able to see their struggle. They got to be able to see their family, their community. At the same time, a book has to be a window. Kid reads a book, they got to be able to see kids who don't look like them, who don't come from their community, who don't necessarily go to church with them. Because the idea is, if you want to create adults who are empathetic, connected, who are, you know, kind and thoughtful, who are not going to sort of immediately, you know, clutch their purse in an elevator or pull out a gun, you know, at a traffic stop, then you've got to make sure that as children, these human beings have books that encourage them to become more human. That's what I try to do. That's what I think most children's book authors ought to be doing, and many are doing, is to write books that are going to help young people become more human so that when they become adults, they are better than we were, than we are.
One of the things about the media industry writ large, which is no surprise, and that extends to the publishing industry, is to borrow the phrase, publishing so white. And I'm wondering, how was that process for you, trying to get this children's book published in an industry that's largely white?
So I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about that reality, because you're right. It's a real thing. Yeah, there's a whole lot of conversation and discussion around, you know, diversity in publishing in particular, like you mentioned. And so my answer to that is, well, what am I going to do to ensure that there are opportunities for other writers like me? And so last year I created an imprint called Versify. You know, publishing is like this dinner party and there's 10 chairs at the table. And for so long, 7 chairs have been occupied. Every now and then, they'll let a guest come in and hang out and eat some of the food. But there's 3 chairs that are just empty. And so with Versify, what I want to do is I want to fill those chairs. I want to make sure I'm bringing more people to the table who have varied sort of ideas and ideals and different backgrounds. And ultimately, I want to publish 10 great writers who can, you know, be at that dinner table. That's my goal.
Well, let's talk a little bit about when you were growing up. Because I remember, you know, when I was growing up, it was rare that there were non-white characters, just period, in a lot of the books that we read, and particularly children's books. So when you were growing up, were there books that you felt really portrayed an image of Black Americans or being Black in the United States that resonated with you?
Absolutely. And again, I don't necessarily buy that notion that there weren't a lot of books that had Black characters. I think those books may not have been accessible. Like I tell people all the time, there's this movement afloat called We Need Diverse Books, which is so important. And here's the thing. We need to embrace the diverse books that are already here. Like that needs to be a part of that equation. We need more writers to have opportunities to get published. And we need to discover and uncover all those treasures that now exist that have been around forever. So when I was growing up, my parents immersed me in writers like Lucille Clifton, Nikki Giovanni, John Steptoe, Ernest Gregg, Langston Hughes. The list goes on and on. And so I want to say that before I went to school, before I entered elementary school, with the exception of maybe Dr. Seuss, all of the writers I read were Black writers.
But granted, you do know you're the exception in that case. I grew up with Black and brown kids in a very right. low-income community, and I can tell you that the eyes started opening for many of us, you know, after maybe reading Native Son in junior high school. You know, like it was a very slow process, and this was a Black and brown community. So you're the exception, I think, for a lot of folks. Maybe back then. Today, I don't know.
I got lucky. You're right. I had parents who were studying education and literature, you know, at Columbia. I got parents who were a part of the Black Arts Movement, who were taking me to poetry and jazz events as a five-year-old. So I get it. That's a great way to sort of bring it full circle, because what I'm trying to do is create literature, create an accessibility to literature for kids so they don't have to wait that long. Because, yeah, the books are out there that are going to help kids become more engaged, become more inspired, become more empowered. And through all of the different initiatives that I'm involved in, that's my goal, to get those books in their hands, all the books for all the kids.
Kwame Alexander is the author of The Undefeated and the founding editor of Versify. Thank you so much, Kwame.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
All right, another day with you all here on The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us. And of course, please call us about anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.